Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everyone. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And a quick reminder to those who are joining us live, if you're interested, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. You'll find a link to join the chat. And you can jump in with the usual suspects, and that's a good place for you. If you have some observations you'd like to share or would like to suggest a question for us to ask our guest that Eagle One and I may have missed along the road, go ahead and hop in there and throw that up forward. We'll try to fold it in as we go forward. And if you're new to Midrats or you want to catch up on some of the shows you've missed, you can always get the archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Or you can subscribe and download the podcast via iTunes so you can listen to at your convenience. Now let's go ahead and head on to the show. For those who spend their commutes listening to NPR, earlier this month you caught what I consider an outstanding series on NPR, one that I wish we could see more of that flavor. This was focused on the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, Dark Horse Battalion, and their experience at their last deployment in Sangam Province. One of the details of the 3rd of the 5th that we're going to tap into there, it is the Marine unit that has suffered the highest casualty rate of any Marine unit in the 10 years that we've been at war in Afghanistan. And our guest to discuss this for the full hour is a journalist who brought this story to the American people, Todd Bowman, the NPR National Desk reporter covering the Pentagon. If you didn't get a chance to catch any of those reports on NPR, over at my home blog, you can find links to the series of reports and also some more background on the 3rd of the 5th. Just go over to my home blog and you can follow the links from there. Highly recommended. In his current role, Tom has traveled to Iraq and Afghanistan often for months-long visits. He knows the place in first person. He's embedded with U.S. Marines and soldiers. Before coming to NPR in 2006, Tom spent 9 years as a Pentagon reporter for the Baltimore Sun. Altogether, he was at the Sun for nearly two decades, covering the Maryland State House, U.S. Congress, U.S. Naval Academy, and the National Security Agency as well. Tom, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, good to be with you guys.
Hey, thanks again for coming on this Sunday afternoon. Just to kind of set the scene for the listeners, if you could please, describe for us Sangam Province, some of its recent history, who was there before the Marines showed up, and what did the Marines brought with them on the ground that may have been different than what had been done before in the last decade?
Well, Sangam is a district in Helmand Province, which is southwest Afghanistan. And the American Marines had been there for a number of years, I think going back to probably 2008 or earlier, and the British had actually been there prior to that throughout the province. And the British had been in Sangam area for about 4 years and, you know, fought bravely, suffered more than 100 dead in the time they were there. But one of the problems with the Brits was they kind of stayed, kind of hunkered down in the central town area, covering the district center and the governor's residence. They didn't really push out into this green area along the river, a lot of orchards and fields and tree lines and so forth. And they brought, just in the past, last year for a little bit, they brought in 3-7 Marines to help them out a bit. And 3-7 Marines got into the green area, green zone area, just a little bit. And then they both rotated out, both the British battalion and the Marine battalion rotated out, and in comes 3-5, the Dark Horse battalion. And consequently, since the British didn't really push out that much, the Taliban, you know, were able to stockpile weapons, were able to have drug labs out there, and really kind of lace this whole area with roadside bombs. So Dark Horse Battalion really walked into some sort of a hellhole here, I guess you could say, and suffered a huge number of casualties, most of them from IEDs. So that's sort of what happened to them in a nutshell during their 7-month deployment. And I'd heard a lot about Dark Horse from fellow reporters. Also, our photographer for NPR was up there a little bit. And also, I heard it from people in the Pentagon. People at who were trying to defeat roadside bombs said, we got a Marine unit up there is getting hit really hard. So I tried to get up there a couple of times during their 7-month deployment, but they just couldn't get me up there with helicopters and all. So I was just south of there in Marja and also Garmsheer area. Never got up to Sangin, but it was always in the back of my mind to kind of do a story on them. What happened here? Why did they suffer so many casualties? And then do a narrative from the time they started right to the very end and what was a homecoming like. And bouncing back and forth between what they were facing in Sangin and also what the families were facing. I spent a lot of time with Marines and the Army over the past number of years. And, you know, we don't do enough on the home front. So I wanted to basically see what was going on at Camp Pendleton while these guys were going through this really tough, tough deployment.
When you write a story or get into the coverage that you got in on this, do you attempt at all to set a sort of a historical background that might be useful to your viewers, I mean your listeners, because you mentioned the losses in Vietnam, I heard, and but I was curious as to whether you understood that these losses in this unit, while severe for the Afghanistan, weren't necessarily even close to the losses that the Marines suffered in some of the Pacific campaigns and all that. And is this part of the communications gap between the military and the civilian world that we don't really get the message of how things used to be? And if that's not a broad enough question for you, I can ask another one.
Sure. No, I mean, what we tried to do was focus on these guys since they had the highest casualty rate in Afghanistan in 10 years. I mean, clearly, if you look back in Vietnam, they had, you know, many fights that were higher casualty. Actually, in Iraq, the Marine units who fought in Fallujah and Ramadi had higher casualty rates. But we want to just focus on this one battalion in Afghanistan to see, you know, what happened to them. And interesting you mentioned Vietnam because the battalion commander, Lieutenant Colonel Jason Morris, his father was a company commander in Vietnam, a Marine company commander, and he suffered 70% casualty rates. And roughly with the Dark Horse, it was probably 20% or so. So we do mention that in the series that, you know, his father, for example, had a very high casualty rate. But we didn't really get too much into some of the previous Marine fights going back World War II, Guadalcanal and Tarawa and so forth. We wanted to kind of stay focused on this one battalion, but again, kind of mentioning in passing some of the earlier and frankly more brutal Marine fights.
Tom, the IED issue, it's something that, you know, I think as people look back in the last decade of war, people will write about it more and more. But I read an article a few months ago that was talking, it didn't even mention the last decade of war, but it was talking about artificial joints and the advances that have been made in artificial legs for people who are missing limbs and all the great technology that we have there, the Paralympics, et cetera, and so forth. But as we all know, that there are spinoffs from technology that is developed in wartime. And when we look in the last decade, especially with what our Marines have experienced in Afghanistan, the IED and the casualties that we've experienced in this war are very different than what people experienced in Vietnam or Korea or other wars, and how that is really impacted wounded that have come home. How much of an impact has there been a discussion with our casualties and IEDs where our Marines are injured and they never see the enemy.
You know, that what they told me, you know, the guys with Dark Horse Battalion, that, you know, the Marines, they're trained for gunfights. They're trained to call in fires. And, you know, they said they really weren't training enough for this level of IED. And I think you hear that a lot from both the Marines and soldiers over there. They'd rather get into a gun battle with these guys because they know they're always going to win. What's really scary for these guys is going on patrol and sweeping for IEDs and hopefully getting them all. But as we saw in the series, that they had a huge number of casualties from IEDs. There was one scene we talk about where the battalion commander heard this whoomph, whoomph, whoomph. At one point, he thought they were taking mortar fire from the Taliban. And as it turns out, it was three Marines stepping on IEDs in quick succession. It sounded like mortar fire. So, again, it's the biggest killer. It's the biggest maimer of soldiers and Marines in Afghanistan. And it's something they're, you know, they've been spent billions and billions of dollars to try to deal with. And they say they're finding a lot more of the IEDs now, but it's still a huge, huge problem over there.
Well, let's kind of set the stage. I mean, I think you've set it up a little bit here, but the 3-5 went into Sangin province, and they were replacing another Marine unit, and the Brits had been there before. And I think you said that what had happened before had given the Taliban the time to set up both weapons caches and implant all these IEDs and other things. Can you kind of lay that out and how, I mean, is this a situation where what military people always say is we you know, no plan long survives contact with the enemy, that they had to overcome a situation they weren't prepared for, but that's somewhat normal, or is this a special case?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, clearly, you know, with most units, they get most of their casualties early on in the deployment when they first start out until they get used to the place. You tend to see more casualties. You know, it's hard to say what, I mean, one of the problems is, you know, they went from basically two battalions down to one was one of the problems. They sent in, as the casualties started increasing, they sent in more Marines. They sent in more mine-clearing equipment, so that clearly helped. And again, there were so many IEDs here. And to this day, Sangin isn't completely pacified. There's still a lot of IEDs there. You know, they set up IED lanes back at their forward operating bases in Helmand to help train these guys, to give them a better sense of the IED. So I think part of it was they clearly didn't have enough Marines there, and they increased the number. They probably didn't have enough IED mine-clearing equipment. And as the battalion commander told me, he said, you know, we really didn't train for this level of IEDs. It kind of took us by surprise. So I think those are the three factors that everybody talked about with Dark Horse.
One of the interesting things, and we've seen it before in other locations, when the casualty rates initially came in and reports got back to D.C., there was a very distinct difference in the reaction between the civilian leadership in the Pentagon, SecDef Gates, and also the Marine Corps uniformed leadership. And I thought during the reports on NPR, the voice of the Commandant of the Marine Corps, I think, made it very clear that they viewed that as a different challenge than perhaps the civilian leadership did. How did that work out?
Well, apparently what happened was as the casualties started to increase in October of last year, they lost 7 or 8 Marines in 2 days, more Marines in 2 days than 3-7 had lost in 6 months. So I think both at Camp Pendleton, at the Pentagon, people were watching this with growing concern. And I was told by both Lieutenant General Rich Mills, who was commanding all Marines in Helmand Province, and also the Commandant, that there was talk among the civilian leadership, Secretary Gates and others, maybe we should just pull these guys out and give them a rest for a while. And both General Mills as well as the Commandant said, no way, that's not how we do business. We never pull out like that. We haven't done it in the 236 years of the Marine Corps, and we're not about to do it now. They said that, you know, the Marines are taking the fight to the enemy, precisely what we wanted, and you would ruin that battalion, you'd ruin morale if you pulled them out at this point. So the decision was made, again, to send in more reinforcements, but not to pull them out for any kind of rest or anything.
When you looked at this this story, the narrative that you set up, the communications back to the families, even though we seem to have more means of communications, what the families were getting was a little, at least the beginning, was a little lagging behind what the events were out there. Can you kind of discuss that?
Yeah, you know, I asked the battalion commander, what would you have done differently with, you know, had you had to do it all over again? And I expect them to talk about some sort of tactics or some sort of training. And he said, I would have created a Facebook page right away, which I thought was kind of interesting. Apparently, what, you know, what's happening was that, you know, you get information so quickly these days with Facebook, with Twitter, with TV news reports, with radio reports like NPR, and people blogging, that there was a lot of information coming back from Sangin about what was going on, you know, the casualty rates. And the sense was among some of the family members of the battalion was that the Marines weren't telling them, giving them enough information quickly. So, you know, there was a little tension there, I think, between the Marine leadership out in Pendleton in particular and the families. And they decided to start their own Facebook page. They decided to have a town meeting to help, you know, speed the flow of information. And they did all that, and that seemed to quiet, you know, some of the family's concerns. But, you know, it's funny, we talked to some family members, some wives in particular, who said, I would, you know, any little bit of information, any shred of information I could get about Sangin and what was going on, I would go for it. I set up Google alerts, for example, or I would just, you know, scour Marine Corps Times in particular to look for any information. And some said, you know what, I didn't want to know anything. I kind of cocooned with my family. I didn't read the papers, didn't watch TV. I, you know, figured if something was going to happen, you know, somebody would get in touch with me. So, it, you're looking at the speed of information today, how quickly people can find out what's going on. And the Marines, their attitude was, listen, we want to be responsible. We don't want to just throw out information. We want to make sure it's the right information before we get it to you. So there was that kind of a disconnect that the Marines, you know, they did a pretty good job, I guess, overall providing information, but there was that problem early on, clearly.
Tom, one of the things that you and your producer, Amy Walters, did with it that I thought was really good in the series, because for those that have been in the military, we know it, we're comfortable with it, but I'm not sure that the rest of the world really understands it. And that's the relationship, the very close relationship between the service members, their wives, and the broader family. You know, people talk about the Marine Corps family or the Navy family. It's not a throwaway line. It's very serious. And y'all use two examples, Corporal Derek Wyatt and his wife, Kate, and Sergeant Ian Tawney and his wife, Ashley. If you could please just describe that relationship and how that works out in the series.
Well, Kate Wyatt and Derek Wyatt, well, first of all, they were both Marines. You know, Kate got out of the Marine Corps just before her husband deployed. Both had served in Okinawa. And, you know, Derek Wyatt had never been in combat before, and he really wanted to get overseas, particularly Afghanistan. And, you know, Kate kind of understood that. She had a sense of, you know, this is something he really wants to do. And, you know, so she, you know, she really encouraged him. If you really want to do this, kind of go for it. And then with the Tawneys, it was a little different. You know, Ashley Tawney was always a civilian, never served in the military. And we found out with a lot of these wives that they didn't have too much military experience. It was all new to them. And both women were pregnant when their husbands left, and, you know, both gave birth, you know, after their husbands were killed. So, and in both cases, you know, they really did look to the Marine Corps as sort of as a family, you know, sort of an extended family. And with Ashley Tawney, You know, she still sees him to this day as very much a family. And I think that comes through, too. And the other wives we talk with, they would reach out to those who lost their husbands. And it was really very powerful, I thought, that they looked at these folks as forever members of their family, very, very tight-knit. And again, you know, those of us who cover military issues, we've been out with the troops quite a bit. You know, you always hear that it's very difficult for those at home and very difficult. The waiting is just going to be really, really gruesome and awful. But you don't really get a sense of that until you sit down and talk with them, what they were going through and how the Marines were really helping them. It was very, very powerful. That was, I found the most powerful part of all of this was talking to the family members and what they'd gone through.
Yeah, I thought that was, that came through well in your program. So I think one of the points that was made by someone in the shows was that it's harder on the wives or the families of home, parents and siblings, in some ways than it is on the troops in the field. I know that from my own deployment experiences, but could you kind of discuss that, how that fit into what you saw in this with the Dark Horse people?
Yeah, one of the wives we talked with, Melissa Fromm, her husband was on his first deployment, and she told us that one night she was sleeping and she woke up, she thought she heard the doorbell ring, and she basically thought that, you know, Marines officers were coming to tell her that her husband had died, and she was hysterical, she was crying, her heart is racing, and she called her dad, who was retired Army, and said, you know, I think someone's at the door, what do I do? You know, I'm really scared. And he said, well, just try to make your way downstairs and look out and see if there's anyone there. And she basically looked through the peephole of the front door, and there was nothing there, no one. She just had a bad dream. And we heard several stories like that from the wives, a phone call that would just give them the jitters. I mean, and that's when you really get a sense of every phone call, every knock at the door, or, you know, they're reading about casualties and they say, oh, I think that's my husband's close friend, or I think he's in my husband's squad. And then they said there's a sigh of relief when you see that it's not your husband's name. But then again, you feel almost guilty and you clearly feel bad for the family member. So all these emotions running through them for 7 months, day after day. I thought that was the most powerful. And these women, you know, they're in their early 20s. And that's what really hits you, you know, is that how young they are and how articulate and how thoughtful they are about what they're going through. I just found that to be really remarkable.
There's, in connection with the story online for the listeners, if you follow the links, there's a picture from the funeral, I believe, of Corporal Wyatt. And that's the one thing that comes through that again, I thought is a great service to the American taxpayers, at least from this series, is it really personalizes, you know, these people and these names, and the fact that, just like you said, these are young women in their young to mid-20s. And for some reason, people make comment about the young people nowadays in their early 20s, but the maturity and the composure and what these people have gone with before they've even been on the planet a quarter century is just really impressive. And I wanted to expand a little bit on the concept of family. It's kind of an inside joke, but you do see it. You know, the military can be a family business. And you mentioned earlier Lieutenant Colonel Jason Morris. His father was an infantry officer in Vietnam. And so he knew what he was getting into. But in the interviews with Lieutenant Colonel Morris, what did you pull out of there about leadership and responsibility and how a leader takes that experience and tries to make something out of it?
Well, again, it's interesting. His dad, he was a Naval Academy graduate, and his dad, of course, was a Marine veteran of Vietnam. And so Jason Morris told his dad that he wanted to be a Marine infantry officer. And his dad said to him, you really have to want to do this because it's very, very difficult. And I think it wasn't until he got to Sangin that Jason Morris understood what his father was talking about. And he had served in Iraq during the rush to Baghdad. But here, he was for the first time in charge. He was commander. He was a battalion commander, and we talked a lot about the issue of not having enough troops and not enough equipment. And you know, he wasn't blaming anyone. You know, and he was basically saying, you know, I'm in command here. I have to decide what to do. It's my responsibility. And again, I said earlier that he set up some IED runs, some mock IED lanes at his FOB to give these guys a little more practice in finding and detecting IEDs. And he told his company commanders, listen, don't rush things. Be very careful. Make sure you're walking in a line behind the guy with the minesweeper. Are you sure you're doing everything right? And, you know, he really tried to figure out how to make this work. He spent a lot of time doing that. And also, you know, he, as the families were really eager for information, he's the one that helped organize that town meeting in Pendleton. He sent messages to the families. You know, he was part of creating that Facebook page. So not only was he facing, you know, a real challenge in Sangin, but also back home as well. And I thought he balanced it quite well. And he never blamed anyone. He never said, poor me. He said, this is something I have to figure out. And overall, he did quite a good job. And he said that, you know, he went to a lot of memorial services when he got home. He said some of the parents were really angry. Why did my son die? My son died for nothing. And he tried to explain to the parents that, you know, they left Sangin in a better place, that markets reopened, kids were going back to schools, that the governor, the district governor, could get around much more easily in his district than he ever did before, that they did make a difference. But then he said, at the end of our conversation, he said, this is a burden I'm going to live with for the rest of my life. So he was really quite a good leader, I thought. And, you know, did it all from the home front to Sangin.
Yeah, I thought that leadership burden that he carried, I thought you did a nice job of comparing it with what his father had gone through in Vietnam, in the sense that because of the high casualty rate, because of the way the troops were rotated in and out of Vietnam, his father never, I think you said, never really got to know his troops. Could you kind of discuss in the same way that the guy, that Lieutenant Colonel in Afghanistan did, could you discuss that a little bit?
Right. You know, during Vietnam, of course, there were individual replacements, just like there were during World War II, that they would just, you know, fill the holes of those who had been killed or wounded. So they didn't all go over as, you know, one unit, you know. And he said, you know, you got to know these guys much better than I did. He said, with me, you know, they would send in individual replacements and these guys would get wounded and be medevaced out. He said, I never really got to know a lot of these guys, even though I had a higher casualty rate. He said, I think it's harder for you because, you know these guys. You've had beers with them. You know their wives. He said, and he compared that to his experience. I thought that was really kind of interesting. I mean, a lot of us know about how different, you know, the individual replacements in Vietnam and so forth and how they do it differently today. But I thought that was really quite interesting. And, you know, that he carried perhaps a heavier burden because he knew these guys so well. It probably hit him much harder than his dad.
Yeah, I think that's one of the lessons that we did learn from Vietnam, at least the military, that we've done well is getting rid of that individual augmentee process they had there. Interesting, we've become similar in many ways to the British regimental system, where people will spend years and years and, you know, we'll at least rotate out, you know, 2 or 3 years after deployment, but they'll spend years and years and years with the same people. Builds a more of a personal relationship. And I think another part of that personal relationship that came out in the series is when you interviewed a lot of the Marines who were recovering or who were injured and were looking forward to their next deployment, the common phrase came up, it was worth it, that the work that they did, you know, the shape, clear, hold, build, where you're getting to that, you know, building stage, and they looked at the sacrifices that they made and their friends made, their fellow Marines, it's very important for them to know it was worth it. How did that theme come out after deployment, and did it ever come out during their deployment, or is that part of the post-deployment intellectualizing what they've experienced?
You know, it's hard to say if they're intellectualizing their experience or kind of trying to justify it in some way, because they lost so many people and so many were maimed from the experience. But we didn't hear anybody who said it wasn't worth it. And clearly, you know, there are some family members out there that told Jason Morris it wasn't worth it. But all the wounded guys we talked with said they did make a difference. They did make it a better place, so therefore it was worth it. And some of the guys said, you know, I'd like to go back again if I could, including some of the those who lost a limb. One in particular, who's a lieutenant, Cam West, who lost a leg, said he's going to try to stay in the Marine Corps. And he said, I'd like to go back and lead men in combat again. I've done some stories in the past of one particular captain with 101st Airborne. He was outside of Kandahar, and I did a profile of him a year and a half ago, and he lost a leg and part of his foot, and he's still out there patrolling with his troops and jumping over grape walls at that time north of Kandahar. So it can be done. They can get out there again, but almost to the man, they all said it was worth it. We made a difference, and many said, if I could, I'd go back and do it again.
As you were working on this on these series of shows, what were you surprised by anything? And if you were surprised, what was it that surprised you the most?
You know, I guess what we were talking about, you know, just you know, a moment ago, that almost all said it was worth it, that they'd do it again. And one guy in particular, Jake Romo, lost both legs, and he was, you know, really gung-ho, said we made a difference. And his wife also said, which is interesting, she said, you know, I think it was worth it too, that, you know, they gave kids a chance to go back to school and made it a better place. But she did say, though, that, you know, had he died over there, and they had two young boys, she said, I'm not sure if I could say it was worth it, but he lost both legs. She said, mentally, he's fine. He's going to try to get into martial arts now, for martial arts training for guys in wheelchairs now. And his, she said, once I knew his mental attitude was okay, she said the legs almost didn't even matter to me. That mentally he was sound, and that's what was really important to me. So, you know, again, it's, I guess that kind of surprised me. You would think you would hear more, it wasn't worth it that I lost a leg or both legs. But again, almost all of them said, you know, it was worth it. And that kind of surprised me. And I guess the other thing, as we said earlier, that the power of the wives at home and what they had gone through and how just horrible it is day in and day out waiting. And they said people have no idea what we go through on a day in and day out basis. And again, that's what really struck me, I think, the most, was what they go through every day. I found the most powerful.
And just a reminder to those that join us late, you're listening to Midrats, and our guest is Tom Bowman, the NPR National Desk reporter covering the Pentagon. And we're talking about his series about the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, and their experience in Afghanistan that you should have heard over at All Things Considered NPR. And, of course, if you want to listen to them, the links are over at my home blog. Tom, you know, building off of what we were just talking about, you talk about different views of the same challenge. When the Marines are now the dark horse, their next deployment, they're going to deploy on a mule on board a ship. And y'all discussed the distinctly different reaction. In the report, it came out as two reactions, the reaction of the family and the reaction of the Marines. But from the listener's point of view, or at least one thing that the dog whistle that I heard, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, but there's also different press reaction. Your colleague over at NPR, at the end, it was almost an uncomfortable, nervous laugh when she heard that, the Marines actually would prefer to go back to Afghanistan as opposed to have a safe deployment doing humanitarian assistance operations or something like that. And there's that different connection between the family and the Marines and the press that, you know, even a decade into war, that they still don't understand why people want to go back to where they come from before when a battle is on. Is there any way that you can that we can bridge that communications gap, or just a cultural thing that will just exist and we need to get used to it?
Well, I think the important thing is, if there's anything that's good that's come out of 10 years of war, it's more reporters are out there getting to know the military, going overseas with them, going to combat zones. So I think there's a comfort level with the guys in the field that we haven't had, probably since World War II, with an Ernie Pyle, for example, and some other reporters like Walter Cronkite that were with troops for an extended period of time. But so, you know, reporters are getting a better sense of the military and how it works, and that's good. But clearly there's still a very big cultural divide, and some argue it's growing even wider between civilians and the military. As we all know, less than half of 1% serve in the military today. Most people don't even know anyone that serves in the military. So there is a concern about that in this growing divide. And that's one of the things I want to look into in the coming months. You know, is this a problem for our country that you have so few people serving? And for the most part, the elites really aren't serving in the military anymore like they used to. You know, decades ago, you would have a lot of people from the Ivy League schools serving in the military. That's all but gone now. Brown University, for example, isn't allowing ROTC back on its campus. Harvard has just allowed Navy ROTC back. And if you look at where people are coming from who are going into the military, it's largely from the South and small towns in the Midwest. The coast, for example, have all but, it seems, written off the military as a possible career choice. So it's, you know, it's again, some people argue that that's a problem for our country, that you're creating almost a military caste system, that most people have no idea what these folks are going through, their families are going through on a day-to-day basis. And then others say that it's really not a problem, that this all-volunteer force has survived 10 years of war. It's an educated force. It's a highly trained force. The Guard and Reserve, for example, have more combat experience than at any time, probably since World War II, that some argue that it's really not a problem. The all-volunteer force has not broken, as some thought it would, but still others are troubled by it, that if you have a force that it comes from such a narrow segment of our society, it'll be easier for the people who run this country to use that as a tool as they see fit. And if most people aren't sacrificing, then, you know, you could almost use them, you know, almost maybe too easily, send them to this engagement and that engagement around the world. And it doesn't really matter, because most people in government, in Congress or the White House, they don't have kids serving, so it's not a personal decision for them. And I think those issues are very interesting. And again, I want to delve into that more in the coming months. I think it's very, very interesting.
It is an interesting series of issues, and one of the things that amazes me about that is that before World War II, we had a tiny military. I mean, much smaller than we have now, and with even less contact, I would think, with the civilian world. And that didn't seem to have bothered many people before World War II, but it seems to be a big issue now. That being as it may, one of the questions that's come up in the chat room is, what, in your view, is there anything the military, in this case the Marine Corps, could have done to help the wives out or the families at home out with some of the stresses they were feeling about their loved ones being deployed?
I think, as you know, Jason Morris, the battalion commander, said, he said, I wish I had set up a Facebook page right off the bat. Maybe that would help. But when any unit deploys, you set up a Facebook page, because most people use, you know, the new media these days, so they could send out information about what's going on. Send out or have town meetings back at places like Pendleton and Lejeune to help these people through. You know, Jason Morris could send, you know, certain weekly reports or monthly reports about what's going on and so forth. I think, you know, better communication is one of the lessons, I think, of the series. particularly if you're going to a really difficult area like Sangin or other areas of Helmand province. You know, some parts of Afghanistan are less kinetic than Sangin, so it might not be as much an issue. Or if you're based at like one of the larger facilities like Bagram Airfield or Kandahar Air Base, it's not going to be as important to keep in touch with the families. But in a place like Sangin, it was so difficult, and you had, you know, high numbers of Taliban and drug traffickers, you really needed to be in better touch and in closer touch with the families, I think.
Recently, really all over Afghanistan, but because we're talking about southern Afghanistan, we'll stick with that. You know, Helmand province, people called Helmand Shire because the Brits owned it. Kandahar was Kandahar. You'd find the Canadians there. And up at Erzgan, you know, that's Erzdom because that's where the Dutch and the Australians were running there. And, of course, the Dutch have taken their forces out, as have the Canadians, besides some trainers. And, of course, the Brits are drawing down as well. What point of view do our Marines and soldiers on the ground over the last few years that have moved into Regional Command South to take over from our allies? And, you know, the Dutch, the Brits, and the Canadians, they were relatively caveat-free and were as kinetic as the Americans in many places. But other of our allies in NATO and elsewhere, between their national ROE and their caveats, they really aren't as flexible, to use that word, as the Americans. Have you seen any change in the view of the soldiers and the Marines toward our ISAF allies?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that last part.
Have you seen any change in the attitude or point of view of our soldiers and Marines towards our ISAF allies, other nations there?
No, I mean, this clearly over the past number of years, since I've been going there, you do hear some griping about a lot of the allies, and it gets into the caveats. They might not be able to go out of their bases as much. They kind of do a little training, but they don't really, as you know, take the fight to the enemy, I guess. They kind of hunker down too much. And you hear it not only with ground troops, but also, you know, with some of the NATO air elements too. I remember talking to some special forces guys about how some of the NATO aircraft wouldn't go below, let's say, 5,000 feet or 10,000 feet. That they were always happy when Americans were on station, they could come in and strafe and come in really low, that you wouldn't get that kind of thing from other NATO aircraft. So, and then, you know, with particular countries with caveats or just, in you know, you do hear complaints about them from Marines as well as soldiers. And also there were clearly complaints about the British in this area, you know, kind of hunkering down in Sangin around the district center, the governor's center, not going out, pushing out to the to take it, the fight to the Taliban. And, you know, some would say, well, the British soldiers are good, but maybe their officers are kind of risk averse. Maybe it was the folks back in the ministry in London that were worried about casualties. And you heard that also from officers as well, that some of the European capitals, you know, they're willing to help out in Afghanistan, but they don't want to see any casualties. That was also a problem with Canada. You know, one Canadian killed would be a huge national debate about whether Canada should still remain in Afghanistan helping out. So it was definitely a problem. You heard griping about it every once in a while, not only from the grunts, but officers as well, that you know, they weren't really in this like the Americans were. I heard that across the board.
As a veteran of the Vietnam era, there was a lot of mistrust in our service. I can speak for myself on this. A lot of mistrust in our service in dealing with the press. Has that finally died, or is there still – did you have open access to the Marines of 3-5? Was there any issue as far as you can see as you've been covering the Pentagon with that kind of communication?
No, there really was never a problem there. you know, we spent a lot of time with the Marines. We've done, this wasn't the first series we've done on Marines. We did another one on 2-8 Marines, America's Battalion, a few years back. So we've developed a lot of good contacts with the Marine leadership over the past number of years. So we, and again, we spent a lot of time with them, particularly in Helmand. So they got to know us a bit. We weren't, this wasn't our first rodeo. So I think that helps quite a bit. But, you know, still throughout the military, you still have a bit of tension between some of the top brass and the press. They're still distrustful. It's almost, you know, a personality kind of thing where, you know, one general or one colonel you get to know pretty well, and the next guy that comes in might say, well, I just don't like the press. I don't see why we have to deal with them. So, you know, a lot of it has to do with how much time have you spent in the field. As you guys know, that goes a long way with military people. You're not just some newbie coming in here covering the military. You don't know F-16 from a Stryker vehicle. So that goes a long way. And also personal relationships you've developed over the years helps quite a bit too. And I think, again, covering these issues, a lot of us over the past decade, we have developed those personal relationships. That does help a bit. But every once in a while, you'll run into a senior officer who just has no interest in dealing with the press. It just doesn't matter to that person. So it really, you know, it kind of runs the gamut. But we've been pretty fortunate, and a lot of that comes from just spending time in the field. There's no replacement for doing that kind of thing.
You know, I'm sure you've seen it with your years around the Pentagon. There are some people who like to throw rocks at the press, but I've always believed that the press has such a critical role here as a connector between the American people and their military. You know, we were talking about how few people serve in the military, how it can be relatively isolated. You know, there's probably a reason why my co-host and I are both Southerners here. But the press is that connector, and it's got to do its job well. Otherwise, the American people and the taxpayers have no idea what's being done in their name. And, you know, there are some people in the press who really make me feel like General Sherman did towards the press. But most of them want to go out there and do a good story and do a good job. As somebody who's been at this for so long, even though we've been out here for a decade of war, is there some things the DOD could do to help the press bring a more in-depth story back to the American people? And do you really see a difference how the information infrastructure or the PAOs of the Army, the Marines, the Navy, the Air Force look at the press? I mean, does one service do it a little better than the other?
The Marines generally are better across the board because their attitude is, you want to find out what we do, just come on out and we'll send you out into the field. And I think they've traditionally been that way. And I'm not sure if it's because, you know, Truman tried to get rid of the Marine Corps after World War II, that there's a sense that we will always tell our story, you know. So you get that sense of them from the Marines. They're much more, they seem more confident in general about what they're doing. They like having reporters out there with them. The other services, the Navy tends to be actually pretty good with press relations, I've found. The Army is larger, a bit more bureaucratic, so it can be harder to get embeds with the Army sometimes. And to try to get information if it's through so many layers, that's a problem. And the Air Force tends to be very, very corporate. It's hard to get out and do stories with them. I guess that's the way I would, you know, describe each of them. But the Marines, I found, tend to be quite good.
I want to visit something you talked about earlier and something that we've discussed before on our show here, which is when you were talking to some of the wounded Marines who were one of their themes was that they wanted to go back. And as you mentioned, one of them had lost a leg and he was trying to get, looked like he was motivated to get back if he could. For many of us who've served, when we mention that, you know, we want to go, overseas to do these things. We get this look from civilians who aren't familiar with the service, like we are completely out of our minds. Or if one of our children has joined the service, as one of mine has, I used to get condolences from people in various organizations when I mentioned that. Do you see that sort of thing? Is that just the civil military gap, or is there just a whole different breed of cat in the services, and maybe we are all crazy?
You know, I don't know what it is. I think it's a sense of service. It's a sense of wanting to fight for your country. And again, sometimes it's a family business that, you know, your son obviously grew up with a dad that was in the military, was comfortable with it, understood it. And some people just really will never get it, that why would you want to risk your life? And I think one of the problems is, you know, if you look at the wars we've been fighting in recent years, these long counterinsurgencies that go on for a decade or more, some people will say, "It's why are we there? Is it worth it? Are we nation building?" So I think, and then Iraq, of course, was very divisive after they failed to find weapons of mass destruction. That was much more of, you had people arguing, you know, both sides about Iraq in particular, less so than Afghanistan. And I remember coming home from reporting in Iraq, and people would just, you know, I told them I was in Iraq, and, you know, with friends or neighbors, and they would just start these, you know, big, long debates about should we be there, should we not. They never found weapons of mass destruction. It's an illegal war. Less so with Afghanistan, but definitely with Iraq. And I think, I guess part of this does get to, you know, it's the insurgencies, how long they take. Is this a real threat to the country? And if it's not, why are we there? Why are we going there? And why would somebody want to go back? I think that's a big part of it. And people look at World War II, clearly a threat to the nation. They look at that as a quote-unquote good war. But these insurgencies, I think a lot of people are scratching their heads saying, you know, why are we there? Why is it taking so long? And why would somebody want to go back to these sort of places that, you know, either A, it's an illegal war, we shouldn't have done it in the first place, or B, once we threw the Taliban over the side, why are we staying and trying to rebuild the place? So I think that's part of it. And the other part is people who have no experience with the military just say, you know, why would you risk your life at all? If you've done your duty, if you've done one or two tours, why would you want to go back? They just can't understand it. So I think that part is clearly the cultural divide that we're seeing.
And it is hard to bridge that. We I wrote an article a while back, you know, kind of discussed that, how at a party or a social gathering, after a while, you find yourself associating with people who either have a family member in the military, used to be in the military, or are presently in the military. You're almost self-segregate. It's very weird dynamic I've seen since I became a civilian a little over 2 years ago. I'm still trying to get my head around it. You know, you mentioned Iraq. We're out of Iraq by the end of the year. We can close at least that chapter of the Iraqi story. But the president, at his West Point speech a couple years ago, originally had the summer of 2011, then we shifted it to the summer of 2014 when forces are coming home. Have you seen any change in attitude towards the leaders on the ground? Is there any sense that we've got to redouble our efforts and move that timeline a little faster in order to prepare the ground for success for the Afghan forces? Or is it just too focused on the end of deployment and we'll let other people figure that out?
You mean with Afghanistan or?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I think with Afghanistan, clearly they see that the clock is ticking. They realize they have to redouble their efforts, not only for combat operations, but also to train the Afghan forces. There's a sense of how do we move the pieces on the chessboard, particularly into next year, as you're reducing 23,000 additional troops. I think there's some angst there with some of the commanders I talk with and some of the leadership about how do we make this work. Particularly if they're going to pull those 23,000 out by, I guess, September. So they'll have to come out before the end of the fighting season, which of course extends until later in the fall. So there is a sense of we've got to maybe redouble our efforts. So there is, you know, depending who you talk with, a sense of we've really got to, you know, do a much better job of training in particular and then finishing combat operations, you know, setting the stage so the Afghans can take over. And I think there's a sense of pushing the Afghans forward in a lot of these areas throughout the country to make sure that they can take over. I think just like you saw in Iraq as well, a sense on the ground of leaders who clearly are looking at the clock and, you know, they feel it much more than others do, you know.
As we, it's a little early probably to be historical about this, but of the some of the fights that we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan, which the Marines and the Army and have been involved, there have been some great feats of arms out there. How will some of those be judged by future generations? I think you mentioned that briefly in some of the reporting.
Well, I think in Afghanistan, clearly, you know, the Marines did quite a good job of pushing into the Helmand River Valley, setting up combat outposts and setting up FOBs down throughout this whole green zone that just extends throughout the kind of the spine of Helmand province. Marja was quite a difficult fight early on. You know, Marja was really a Taliban nest and a nest of drug traffickers that not only you didn't have any U.S. forces going there, but really no Afghan forces are in there for a number of years. So some of those fights were quite difficult. The fighting, I was around Argandab area north of Kandahar. There was some real tough fights up through there. And they really took it, you know, village by village. You know, and it took them quite a long time in all these areas, really a number of years to get a take the fight to the Taliban in some of these green zone areas, not only in Helmand, but also outside of Kandahar. Tough fighting. They lost a lot of people. Clearly, things are getting better in those areas. And then when you look at Iraq, clearly, you know, fights like in Fallujah, very, very tough Marine fight there. That'll go down in history, I think, is one of the, you know, stellar, tough fights of the Marine Corps as we look decades into the future. And the question really with both countries is, you know, can they provide for their own security? And that's still an open question, I think, in both Iraq and Afghanistan. They both have, you know, a lot of troubles internally that they have to overcome. You look in Iraq, the Sunni-Shia split. You look also in the Kurdish areas in the north, between the Kurds and the Arabs around Kirkuk. So they have some internal problems they're going to have to deal with. And the same is true also in Afghanistan, that, you know, the central government is seen as widely corrupt, the Karzai government. The governance part of this, the most difficult part, they really haven't pushed out enough. You keep hearing from American military and civilian leaders that, you know, we provided security for them. Now they have to step up and provide a better government, a less corrupt government for their people. They have to provide services for their people. And that clearly in Afghanistan, for example, is lagging behind. So, you know, the reason people have insurgencies is because the government is either non-existent or predatory. So in both countries, the government and the leadership class, they really have to step up to the plate and provide a better life for their people and resolve some of these internal problems. And really the jury is still out, I think, in both countries. Clearly we'll be in Afghanistan at least through the end of 2014 with combat forces. As far as what happens after that, I think you're looking at the same issue that you have in Iraq, that there will be X number of American trainers and X number of American financial support to keep these countries, you know, heading in the right direction. So it's still an open question about what America's role will be in both countries, and most importantly, whether both leadership classes in both countries can do what they have to do.
We just have a few minutes left here, but one thing I wanted to bring in from our chat room, and we can go a few minutes over. It's all recorded, and we'll get it out there. But it's a really important question. You know, we covered the macro sense of what's next, but you know, one of the great things about your series with Third of the Fifth over on All Things Considered is you fleshed out the personal impact, and as you've seen firsthand. We have a lot of wounded warriors coming back that some of them, if possible, will go on with a military career, but a lot of them will need to reintegrate into the civilian workforce and into society in general. How do you see, considering some of the past, especially some of the unfortunate things that happened to those that returned from Vietnam, but how do you see about the present-day American view of accepting these warriors home and reintegrating them into our society?
Well, clearly it's better than in Vietnam when, you know, as you guys know, how veterans were treated when they came home. There was a lot of anti-military feeling back in the mid to late 70s. It's different today. I think people are more accepting of the veterans coming home. On the one hand, but in some respects, it's almost an apathetic stance too, as well, that we didn't see in Vietnam. Vietnam, post-Vietnam, was very political. Today, I think people, you know, they either say welcome home or thanks for your service, but a lot of them, the sense I get is they just really don't even think about it much. It's really, you know, again, sort of an apathetic stance. The other issue you have, I think, with guys coming home, the unemployment rate is higher for veterans by about, you know, across the board, it's about 9% unemployment. For veterans, it's about 11% or more. And part of that is the economy's in such bad shape that no one's hiring. I know the Obama administration is coming up with tax credits to hire veterans. But the sense I get from, you know, talking to people who cover business and so forth is one of the issues for hiring these guys is people are concerned about PTSD or traumatic brain injury. As far as, you know, having that question about, you know, if I hire this guy, is he going to be a good worker? Are there going to be problems with this guy? And the other thing with Guard and Reserve people, if they hire these folks, are they going to be off doing something, you know, for 6 months or a year that I'll have to, you know, hire someone else for a temporary measure? So I think that's a problem as well. But, you know, overall, you don't have the serious, you know, anger of a lot of the folks in the country toward the veterans you had during Vietnam. But there are still problems to this day with the veterans returning home now.
And, Tom, that was a very quick hour. I wanted to thank you very much for coming on this Saturday. And you mentioned earlier in the show that you were going to be you know, looking at the civilian-military divide and maybe doing some reporting on that. But what other projects do you have in work right now that the listeners can come find you speaking on?
Well, I hope to go back to Afghanistan in the spring. I hope to go back to the Sangin area. Get up through there up in northern Helmand province and also head to the eastern part of Afghanistan as well, where really, you know, you can see more of a shift of U.S. forces in that direction because that's where the big fight's going to be in the coming months and years. So I'll be working that. Budget issues are always something that we're working on. You know, how much the Pentagon's going to have to cut in the coming months and years, that's going to be a huge issue. So look for more coverage from Afghanistan and look for a lot more coverage about Pentagon budgets.
Outstanding. And Tom, thanks again, and thanks for everybody that joined us live and for those getting on the archive. And we hope to see you again on MIDRAT.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, thanks so much, guys.
Or you'll be to blame for love has fairly dwelled.